Mini-episode 1734 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1734. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris coming at you today with one of our favorite FDH Lounge dignitaries and our first post-original FDH Lounge dignitary from back in 2007, the great Russ Cohen from Sportsology, proprietor of that great site. Of course, also NHL Draft Buzz, which is very timely for this time of year. But specifically today, we are talking about the 2024 Stanley Cup Final and something that turned out to be pretty epic. After a wet fart of the first three games in the series, it ended up going the distance and ended up being very, very memorable. And again, we have Russ Cohen here today to talk about that with us. We did, of course, the preview of this series. We broke it down. We both predicted that Florida would win. I had predicted Edmonton over Florida in seven prior to the start of the playoffs. When I broke it all out, I had this as the matchup. I had Edmonton in seven. Felt pretty good about that pick going into this last night, I would say, as we are taping this now. But it didn't turn out to be the case. And I guess we'll try and diagnose that a bit as we're going on now of why the quote-unquote momentum shifted the way that it did in Game 7. But for that, we bring in, as I said, my friend, the great Russ Cohen. Russ, great to have you on here, my man. And we ended up seeing a pretty epic Stanley Cup final after the way that it started, which was, of course, nothing special at all.
We did. I mean, I was asked from 06 to now which was the best one. I really thought this was the best one because, you know, this one looked like a sweep, and then it wasn't. And then some people were questioning, could Florida now even win this, and could Bob even play in net? And I don't recall another series like this that had the ups and downs and then eventually had us all sitting at the edge of our seat, even though Florida never was behind in that game. It's interesting. I look at it like this. It wasn't so much the momentum, because I think there was a little home ice, but nothing great. I think what happened was, and I had said this to somebody pregame because they asked me about it. I thought it was like, hey, Florida's going to get back and play their physical game. Game sevens are, you know, historically tight. So you knew it was going to be tight. And I had said days ago that Florida was going to have to plug up that hole for the shorthanded goals on the power play, because even if the power play stinks, you shouldn't give up shorthanded goals. And they did. They plugged that up. And because that was how Edmonton got momentum in a couple of the games with those great shorthanded goals.
Yep.
One of them, the Connor Brown one. So, you know, when that dried up, then Edmonton was going to have to, like, get to the net again, and they couldn't. I looked at it like a basketball game. I saw that, you know, Mikkola was going to be on, like, Draisaitl, and I don't remember, maybe it was Forsling on McDavid, but then if Draisaitl looked like he was getting free on the other side, they double-teamed him. Mm-hmm. And so they always kind of dared Edmonton to make that cross-ice pass to an open guy, but just kept and stayed on Draisaitl and McDavid, and they did a good job with that. You know, someone like Nugent Hopkins didn't really step up in that game. And Henrique, who actually had really good playoffs as like that veteran, didn't really step up. So, you know, it became like a goaltending battle. And the interesting thing was, and I just knew this instinctively, not because I played some hockey, but it's just when you watch enough hockey, you kind of can tell some players and whatever. When I saw Reinhart alone coming down on the wing, I knew he was going to fake the pass and shoot. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why Skinner thought he was going to pass and he left too much corner. And that you can't do it with a guy who could score like that. So that to me was like the death blow, even though it was a really close game. But Florida had some other good chances too. The other thing was, I thought Knobloch is an excellent coach. I really did. I watched it. I went to a game once in Erie, drove like 8 hours to see Connor McDavid against Aaron Eckblad. It was Barry against Urie.
Wow.
And this was the year that I went and did it on purpose, right? Because as a prospect guy, I knew Eckblad was going to go first overall. McDavid was going to go first overall potentially. So I wanted to see these guys. Plus McDavid played, Connor Brown played in that game, and a few other players. And I just was, you know, and Knobloch was the coach. He was McDavid's coach.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this was something where I felt like I was getting a flashback, because when I saw Ekblad manhandling McDavid, I was just like, wow, you know, this is something, because these guys have messed up a lot before, because, you know, this is not anything new. So it was interesting. It was one of these things where Edmonton all of a sudden decided in the third period, we're desperate.
Mm-hmm.
But they decided it really early. So then that's like, okay, so that means you're putting, you know, McDavid and Draisaitl together. Fine. All right. You want to do that. And every other shift, they were out there. And the problem with that was, you knew, like, I was looking at them at the 8-minute mark saying, nah, they don't get a goal soon. They got to rest these guys. They never really got a rest, right? And they finally get the goalie pulled like a minute and a half. They get their guys on the ice and they're dead. Like, they couldn't even control the puck at all. Florida completely controlled the puck, almost scored twice. There was no push at the end. They were dead. And I thought that was, like, not bad coaching, but desperate coaching, that you should have planned it a little better so that you could have had those guys out on the ice, like, maybe the last 2 minutes of the game, not, like, three quarters of the third period.
Yeah, and I want to ask follow-ups on a few things you said, but let's start with the last point there, because that was one that I was going to raise, which is, again, what Chris Knobloch did and the amount of ice time specifically that McDavid and Draisaitl got in the third period. Again, especially in the last 8 minutes or so of the game, I think, again, that was a grievous mistake, I think. And again, now you can look at it and say that at the end of the day, do they have enough on their lines, each of those guys, to where they can keep the other team honest and not be getting the double team attention? Maybe not. But here's the thing. You skate with the guys that you have, right? And the guys that they had were explosive. What was it, 18-5 in games 4, 5, and 6? So yeah. It's one of those deals where you have to trust what you have. And the timing of this is just very interesting. That I know that the lucky folks in Crave got season 3 of Shoresy a couple weeks ago. It just dropped on Hulu this past weekend.
I still have never watched that.
You would truly, truly love it. I've now watched season 3 twice, which is not hard to do because it's only 6 episodes of less than a half hour. But here's the thing, Russ. The catchphrase for season 3, you go till you can't go no more. And it felt like that's what the mentality was in Game 7. It's a Game 7. You got to go. You go. You can't go no more. But it's like you have to parcel out the minutes, because, again, what good does it do to have 2 of the 5 best players in the world, the best player in the world, and another top 5 player in the world, if they are ineffective because they're gassed? It's one of those things where, like, in October baseball, when these dumb managers want to, you know, bump up a starter, you know, on a day's less rest. Well, we're going to have to do this to get to a Game 7 or a Game 5. And it's like, you have to win those 2 games anyways. You want to have the guy in there at his most effective level. I just don't get why in different sports, coaches and managers don't always get that.
Yeah, and Knobloch did a great job in the series. I'm not ripping him. But for this was definitely an issue.
A boo-boo.
There's no question. We all saw it. I mean, we all saw it. And so, yeah, I mean, when you're in a Game 7 in a series like this, the slightest mistake could cost you, right? And that's it. It could kill you. And it did. It killed them. So I just, you know, at the end, Florida was the team that we thought. Maybe, you know, not you at one point, but a lot of us. And they seemed like the deepest team. They still seemed like the deepest team until the day after the parade and free agency hits and they had 10 free agents. But that's beside the point. That's the weird NHL season for you. But, you know, when I look at it, I'm like, they're the team that deserved to win. It's not saying Edmonton didn't deserve it. It's just that Edmonton had this a miracle comeback in the season just to make it to the playoffs, and they got hot. But they never were as deep as Florida. Like, you knew matching up, they couldn't match up line for line and couldn't match up in net. But, yeah, you know, it kind of went their way for a while. I've always been a fan of Bob. Yeah, it looked like his career was tailing a couple of years ago, but then last year he got it back. And so I always supported him because I know what kind of battler he is. And, you know, he got his A game back and, you know, sure enough, he really won the cup for him. And, you know, you look at it and it's like, yeah, now he's got two Vezinas and a Stanley Cup win. And, you know, I covered him, you know, when he was a rookie. So, and then Brzgalov ran him out of town, but that's a, you know, a whole other thing for a whole other day. But, you know, it's one of those situations where you look at it, you say, yeah, the best team won, but I think the best teams were in it. I know some people will say, well, Dallas was better than Edmonton. Well, you know, it doesn't matter. They weren't there. So I'm never this guy that, well, the best team didn't win or, you know, the best teams weren't there because of the grind. It's like, you know what? With the grind of the NHL, and as good as these two teams were and what happened in this series, these were the best two teams.
Yeah, I think it definitely played out that way in the end. And again, to make another cross-sport analogy here, which I love doing on this show, when you look at somebody that came up as a highly touted prospect, Reinhart was, second in his draft class, right, I believe?
Yeah,
so, I think so. But having the kind of career that he's had, and he's had, at times, a good career, at times, very good. This year, he became great. And for him to have scored the game-winning goal last night, who did that put me in mind of, except for the fact that in the Game 7 it didn't happen to go his way, but Sandy Alomar Jr. in 97. And he's had a better career than Sandy Alomar Jr. had, but it's very similar, right? Like, there's that year where, like, when everybody expects you to be this uber blue chip kind of a guy, there's that year you put it all together. And it's going to be very interesting to see if he stays at this level. Because if they do, maybe we won't look back on this in quite the same way, the way that we look back on Sandy Alomar in 97. But it's one of those things where it's like, it's just, if there was ever a year that he was going to get the game-winning goal in Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final, it would be this year. Because this year, he was the guy that everybody thought he was when he was picked second in the draft.
True. I mean, he's been that guy for a few years now. I think he's had some really good years.
The big breakthrough on goals, though. I mean, 58 yes. goals. That's what I mean, you know.
I kind of think this is going to be like Brady Anderson. He's going to fall back to 35 again. It's hard to stay.
Luis Gonzalez.
Yeah, Luis Gonzalez. It's hard to stay in the 50s. So I think, but I think that also was his first goal of the cup, right? I mean, he had gone cold.
Yeah. True.
So, yeah, but it was apropos because he was their best goal scorer, and he had a tremendous season, and now he's going to get a big payday. I still think Florida's going to retain him and lose Montour. I think ultimately that's probably the way it goes unless they do something very creative. But, yeah, Sam Reinhart could always play. I mean, right now, sure. You know, at this point in his career, he's not a point-a-game player, but he's got 255 goals. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if we look it up, I'm going to do a quick scan, thanks to HockeyDB, and just look up for that draft who has the most goals, and he is fourth.
Okay.
Pasta is first. Leon Draisaitl is second. Braden Point, the big surprise of that draft,
sure.
Third. So Sam Reinhart is fourth. He's got more goals than Nylander.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's pretty good stuff.
You could probably win some barroom bets on that one. I wouldn't have bet on him having more goals than Nylander. That kind of surprises me.
No, I wouldn't either. Nope. I'm with you. If I'm being honest. I would not have. And to be honest, you probably wouldn't bet your guy Dylan Larkin being sixth in points.
No.
Even though he's a really good player, he's sixth in points in that draft class, which is a hell of a draft class if you think about it.
Yeah, I wouldn't have necessarily bet on that being the case either. And again, yeah, I think Florida would, it would behoove them to keep him at all costs. As far as his draft mate in that class there, Draisaitl, the way that things went, I was kind of looking at it. One of the reasons that I thought that Edmonton was going to win Game 7 was, again, you know the way that I tend to look at these things here, regression and progression to the mean. I'm like, Edmonton made it to Game 7 with very little from him. So you got to think that is going to mean something, and it turned out to mean exactly bupkis. And that's one of those things here where he's catching probably more heat than any player that I can see coming out of this thing here from social media. And
people don't realize how banged up he was. We saw, I had made a remark before this game seven, like two days before, if there weren't all these days off in between, would Draisaitl even be playing? Like, would he even be able to get back out on the ice? And some were like, yeah, this is a big edge for Edmonton because he certainly was being able to stay out there because of the amount of days off. But sure, still, his effectiveness was down. He could skate and carry the puck in the zone, but he was hampered.
Yeah, and I think I saw, too, wasn't he one of the ones that was beaten on the scoring chance there that Reinhart converted on? So there's that.
Yeah.
And that's going to be something that kind of lingers on in people's memories. But you had a lot of so many different memorable things that happened here through the course of the series. And again, I'm sure there are some Panther fans that will tell you it wouldn't have even gone seven were it not for the momentum getting shifted against them in game six. The whole thing here with calling the offsides on the goal that would have made it 2-1 relatively early on. And that was one where, again, in looking at the replay, I think part of it is you have to extrapolate. And it's the speed of the skater versus the speed of the puck. And so I'm looking at this here, and maybe it's the extrapolation in my mind, but it appeared to me to be an offsides call, a correct one, in as much as that it seemed to me that the skate was in all likelihood in the zone there before the puck was. So what was your kind of sense on that? I know that it was close. I know that it was a bang-bang call, and that some folks thought it needed to be a little bit more clear-cut to overturn it, but it seemed like the evidence was there to me.
No, I mean, the evidence was ultimately there. Sportsnet had the shot. If you saw, like, when ESPN tried to show it, it was blurry.
Right.
It was blurry. We couldn't see anything.
Right.
So that was a fail. But my problem is, and I think Sean McDonough was the one who said this correctly, is that the spirit of the rule was originally, hey, we don't want guys, and we always use Danny Briere as the example, 6 feet into the zone and no offsides was called, and it's a big goal, right? So we're doing this to keep everybody honest and not to cheat.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea was, and McDavid had complained about this, and so had a few other players, even though it didn't, when it went against them in the past, was that how many frame-by-frame shots are you going to look at to get this call right? And is it really in the spirit of the rule? And my feeling is you should get like 2-3 minutes to look at it, and that's it. And if you can't determine it in that, and you don't have that shot that by then you shouldn't have it. And I think they took longer than that. And I'm just saying, you take long enough on anything, you'll find more things than what's being called. But so for those people that, say, well, you want to get it right, yeah, sometimes you do, but that really affected the game. Like, we all know that was a momentum changer, that goal. And the minute it didn't happen, that team just collapsed.
Yeah. But I would also say, too, it's on them not to collapse when that happens.
No, of course. But, you're human. Like, it's bound to happen.
Yeah. And that the initial comments that I saw from Paul Maurice, I was prepared to jump on him a little bit. And then I saw a little bit of context and I was okay with it. When he said that he would not have, if the shoe was on the other foot, would not have called for the replay. I didn't like the implication that he thought it was unsportsmanlike to do so. He was just saying when it was that close, he wouldn't have risked a penalty kill situation to be on that. So that's fine. If he meant it on a tactical level and not like being passive. Okay. At first I thought he was being passive aggressive.
He was passive aggressive with every Emily Kaplan interview right after penalty, saying, they keep calling these against us. Like, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And he was right to some degree. There were some really bad calls.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, there was some interesting...
Like, that Kachuk call was terrible. Like, where was he supposed to go? He wipes out, he covers his head because he doesn't want to get skate in the head, and he doesn't want to get hit with the puck, and he runs into a player, but, like, where's he supposed to go?
And here's the interesting thing, is that, like, you don't expect, for lack of a better term, case law to be made out of Game 7 in a Stanley Cup Final, but it's like, I'd have to rack my brain to think, and you'd probably have to rack yours, and you've seen so much more hockey than me. It is not a commonplace occurrence at all for a guy to get wiped out and take somebody else out in that
manner. No, of course.
Unusual. So it's a thing where, like, to let it go, and I agree with you, they should have let it go. I absolutely agree that shouldn't have been called. But it's a thing where, particularly in a high-profile situation, Is there potentially a danger that that could become a tactic subsequently? And like, oh, what do you want me to do? I lost my balance. I was whatever. I didn't mean to take that.
You know what, though? I will say this. Just, you know, having skated a bunch of my life, not very well, but still have done it.
Okay.
It's hard. It would be hard for a player to wipe out intentionally like that and have that kind of momentum going towards another player. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It has to happen almost by accident. It's almost no other way that it can happen that way, because yeah. I don't know if you can manufacture that.
Well, the height of my skating prowess was being able to make somewhat haltingly the figure eights there at the local skating rink. So,
oh, that's more than I could do. So good for you.
Well, wait a minute. Didn't you play in one of the media games for the Winter Classic?
Yeah, I played in a couple of them. Doesn't mean I could play.
Dude, I couldn't even wield a stick out there. Yeah, you're far more advanced than me as far as like being able to do that. If you put a hockey stick
in
my
hand, sense, but not for the skating.
I would collapse immediately. I played a lot of broom ball in college and a lot of.
Yeah, yeah. I played like, you know, deck hockey and street hockey, a lot of that.
The worst experience I ever had. The one night, because Thursday night in Athens, Ohio, it would be a night generally to go get plastered uptown, and I did that, assuming I'd be playing defense again, and they moved me off of defense, and I was completely green in the face by the end of the evening, so that was a mistake.
Yeah, and I did roller hockey, too. See, roller hockey I was better at because I took roller skating lessons so we can get into the rink early back in the days when roller skating mattered.
Okay.
You know, go on like a date night or something like that, and so, you know, that worked out well. So yeah, I was a good roller hockey player because I could really skate backwards. You know, hockey skating backwards, I don't even try, man. I've managed to figure out how to play without doing it.
Roller skates are another thing where I've struggled to keep my balance as well. Okay. I've only ever done it a few times, but never very well. But a guy who has done all of this, of course, at the highest level, Connor McDavid. This is a thing where, again, getting the Conn Smythe coming out of the Stanley Cup final here. Unusual for a player from the losing team, all the more unusual when it's not a goalie on the losing team. And this is a thing where, again, as people are starting to ask the question now a little bit at age 27, as far as, you know, will he get one? Will he get to lift the cup at some point in his career? Because you figure he's probably roughly at about the midpoint and past that in his prime. I mean, his prime probably has a good another 6-7 years to go, I would say. But
he might be like Crosby. He might have more.
You can start to see that. And my guess is he'll have the same career trajectory. So he's going to keep getting looks here for another 10 to 12 years, I would say. But yeah. It's interesting, because I did a little bit of research on this, and it's so funny because, like, the research shows that it's an absurd question to ask. It's really an absurd question because hockey and basketball are not at all like baseball and football, which have so many more positions out there. In hockey, there's no equivalent of Ted Williams. There's no equivalent of Dan Marino. I'm looking to see, like, who's the best player in hockey history, non-goalie, never to lift the cup. I mean, is it Marcel Dion, maybe?
He's always the one.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's like, but we can agree, and no offense to Marcel Dion, but Connor McDavid is a much better player.
Sure, but Dion was, you know, a
Dion
top
was Dion was
6-7 player in the game when he was playing.
Absolutely,
for a long time.
Absolutely, but I mean, McDavid is going to be top 5, top 10 at the very worst all time. Like, he's going to be among the elite of the elite in every way. So, like, in hockey, It just kind of brought it home to me again that, like, players that are at that level, they don't not lift the cup at some point. It's one of those things where, like, in the NBA, Elgin Baylor was...
But Ray Bourque got within inches of not lifting the cup.
Okay.
I mean, it took him leaving to do it.
True,
so,
but...
It's hard. Sometimes it does happen to some great players. It does.
It does, but like the truly incandescent, right? I see him as one of the truly incandescent players ever to play. No offense to Ray Bourque. I mean, a really great player and everything like that. And again, how shameful that Colorado Gravy trained it and retired his jersey number. But that's another story for another day. But
you know, that's your Red Wings showing.
That is. I think that was shameful. Hey, we didn't retire Luke Robitaille's number. We had dignity on that one. He belonged to the Kings. He was just with us when we won the title.
No, that's fair. That's
you know,
fair.
We didn't stoop to that. But no, as far as it goes, like anybody that's like that great, because like in the NBA, the best player probably was Elgin Baylor that didn't win a title. You know, some might say Barkley. Jerry West came close to not being or to being in that category before winning
one of his career. He did it against the Knicks.
Yes,
I remember.
That's right. Yes, RIP the logo. A true great. We've had a lot of greats dropping over recently. Him, Willie Mays. It's a sad time.
Yes.
But it just struck me again when I was doing a little research for the show here that like in basketball and in hockey, you just don't have that. The truly incandescent players will get that at some point. And it's one of those things where I think the only question, if you're an Edmonton Oilers fan, is will it happen while he's in your jersey or will it happen when he's in somebody else's? And again, this contract has
a point. In a year, that'll be the big question.
Well, that's true. That's true. And, you know, he's going to have the ability to kind of look around and see. And, you know, this is a thing here, too. And I want to say this in a way where I'm not sounding overly bitter about the last 5 to 8 years of the Ken Holland run in Detroit. But, you know, the before and after of his career, you have salary cap versus no salary cap and everything like that. So I'm trying not to let my own feelings about that seep into this question. But it's a thing where I want to grant that his hands are tied a little bit in the sense of when you have two of the five best players in the game, the way the league is structured these days, it really is hard to build enough depth around them. I'm impressed with the job that Holland's done adding around them. He's done more than I thought he would be able to be perfectly honest with you. But
I don't know. I'm going to stop you there and say that it finally worked this year.
Yeah.
But he made a lot of bad trades. He spent some stupid money, like a Darnell Nurse. That was stupid. The goaltending was never right. And this year, it wasn't even right for a lot of the years, and they were spending money on the wrong goalies. So it was a great chance of it never happening. But the fact that he got to the Cup, you have to give him his credit for that, and it did finally click. But
unbelievably, in this conversation, I'm being the one who's generous to him in the sense of, I know it's the taller than Mickey Rooney award, but this is by far the most depth that they've had on that Edmonton team. That's why they got where they got, yes?
Right.
Okay.
That's true. I also want to say that, to be fair to Ken Holland, you know, a lot of times when things were going right in Detroit, they had this guy named Jim Nill there as an assistant.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
And somehow that guy has managed to do pretty good on his own for Dallas, wouldn't you say?
Dude, let me tell you something.
Two GM of the Year awards.
Yes. I had dread in my gut when he got hired away because everybody knew that, right? It was the biggest open secret in hockey. He was the key to the European pipeline, was he not?
I believe so.
He was. And it was like the minute he left, I'm just like, oh, I mean, like, I didn't really think that they were going to get exposed to the degree that they did, like in the 2010s and everything like that. But it is a thing where, again, part of it is, too, as the Red Wings aged out at that point there, it was a little bit of a different story. And sometimes it is a matter, I can't believe how fair I'm being to Ken Holland here tonight. But it's one of those things, I think, of like matching the skill set to the situation. And that, like, if you give Ken Holland a team where there's, you know, a couple of superstars there and everything like that, that, you know, he's going to be able to put some more pieces around them. You ask him to rebuild, and it was a thing where, and he refused to even outright rebuild with the Red Wings because he wanted to keep that stupid, useless playoff streak alive just so we could get humiliated in the first round year after year. But that's a thing where matching up somebody to a situation, once again, cross-sport analogy, myself and FDH Lounge dignitary Ben Chu called it a year ago when the Detroit Pistons hired Monty Williams, who did a really good job in Phoenix, got them to the finals. But in New Orleans, in a situation where they were trying to build, he was nothing special. You bring him into a young team in Detroit just because he's a name guy that took a team to the finals, and Ben and I were like, this is not going to end well. Little did we know, after a year, he'd be gone and have $65 million in guaranteed money to spend. So, a lot of times,
it's crazy how bad Detroit got. I don't even follow the NBA. And I caught on to that. How many wins did they end the season with?
It was like 15 or 18. It was somewhere in there. They were pathetic. And it's a thing where they hired the wrong guy for the situation. They wanted a name. They wanted to win the press conference. And they did that. I'll never forget, because I can sometimes pull in Detroit radio stations, talk stations from Cleveland, and before they hired Monty Williams, I heard some talk show honk saying something like, there were six big names left on the market, and five of them are gone. They got to get Monty Williams. That's what happens when you listen to the talk shows, ladies and gentlemen. And that's a thing where Ken Holland, at the very least, I mean, if it was an Edmonton team that was completely rebuilding, they'd still be rebuilding forever. But the fact that he was able to get enough pieces in there to at least get them this far is, you know, a tribute to, again, matching up his skill set at least somewhat to what they do. Now it's a matter, like you said, of convincing McDavid long term that they're going to continue to be able to do that, because the world is his oyster.
McDavid's going to be there longer than Holland, because I don't know, you know, I don't know how much longer Holland will be there. Wouldn't shock me if he retires now. So yeah. I just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and that's a situation that really bears watching. And of course, again, Florida. Just coming back to this and how they were able to do it in Game 7, I will say, I'll give a tip of the hat to FDH Lounge dignitary Chris Galloway. He and I were texting last night, and my expectation was, because I said to you when we did the preview for this, the longer this thing goes, the harder road that Florida traveled to get here is going to manifest itself. I felt that tired legs were part of the story of Games 4, 5, and 6, and then you have to make another, 2,200-mile trek back to your building for Game 7 after being completely demoralized, humiliated for three games, et cetera, et cetera. And this is where, again, Paul Maurice deserves all the credit in the world, because coaches will talk about going tabula rasa, and it's a one-game season, and the only thing that matters is what happens tonight. But a lot of times that's gaga. When you've been getting your ass beat the last several games, all the momentum's behind you, and for all you know, maybe you've been figured out and solved by the other team's scouting. But he made it happen. Paul Maurice, from now until the end of time, will serve as an example for embattled coaches in a Game 7, because he said that. He said that we're going to make it a one-game season tonight. Nothing that happened before matters, and he made it stick.
He did, and again, considering how much he blew up, you know, with the Barkov goal getting off the board, he really reeled it back in. He deserves everything he got. He does. It's tremendous. The FDA, you know, when he was talking was great.
Yeah.
If you remember that movie Air America, that was like their slogan for that. That's my brain went there. So that was good. I mean, all of that made complete sense. I was happy for him. And I know everybody's thought pattern is, well, you know, look what Florida, they were building for this year and they got there. So that'll happen to Edmonton, right? The only difference is Bill Zito did a masterful job 2 years ago. I don't know. He turned around something like 7 or 8 roster spots and did it again for like at least 4 to 6, I think, for this year.
Yeah.
Probably about 4. And, you know, that's not easy to do. And so that's going to be a tough job for whoever's GM. If it's Holland, great. If it's somebody else, great. But it's not a guarantee Edmonton gets back there. Like, there are teams that go to the Cup and then they start declining again. So you don't know. And honestly, I don't know if Florida's getting back there. They have 10 free agents.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be an open question. But one of the things is one of the things people point to the most over the course of the last 2 years as far as Florida's transformation from when they ended up being the President's Trophy winner that ended up being eliminated in the first round to getting to this point was really, really, really gritting up this roster. And that was one of the things that really served them well in the playoffs. And
you got to have that grit. You can't have too much grit, though.
You can, but here's the thing. The amount of distance that they had to travel to get there, I think, is significantly less than Edmonton would have to, right? If Edmonton made that their big focus for the off season, I don't think they could do it all in one off season, maybe two.
Right, I agree.
So it would be harder for them to get back to that point, but yeah.
And they got to focus on getting Draisaitl under contract. So.
They do. And that's, you know, keeping the dynamic duo together. You know, that's a big legacy thing here for these players to get back. That dynamic duo to the Stanley Cup final and getting it done. But this is one of these things where, you know, coming into the Stanley Cup final, this was something where, because again, you and I talked about this, the Canadian ratings, of course, never count towards, you know, what ABC is getting for the Stanley Cup final. So, you know, how's this even going to do in the ratings and everything like that? And then it started out to be as big of a stinker as the NBA finals ended up being, and then pulled out of that tailspin and became arguably the best Stanley Cup final of the 21st century. And I saw a thing yesterday that, like, ABC was going to end up making something like $12 million on the series going as long as it did. So for something...
Because game six, that Friday game had a 4.2 million viewers. And yes, compared to some other sports, it stinks. But for the NHL, that's really good.
Sure.
And so... And that's better than it's been in years. So that was nice to see. And I'm sure this game seven, a lot of looky-loos probably checked in on this one. So my guess it'll be probably like 5 or 6 million.
Yeah. So you never know sometimes based on the combination that you're going to get coming into a Stanley Cup final. And it did, of course, have the draw of two of the best, the five best players in the world being in this. And again, these storylines of, will it be the first one ever for Florida? Will it be the end of the run for Canada with the 31-year drought, which goes longer, which has now manifested itself through multiple Game 7s, two Game 7s now that Edmonton has been a part of.
Every team has gone and lost at least once except for the Jets.
That's right. I was going to say except for Ottawa, but they had that one back in 07.
Yep.
Yeah, and Vancouver and Edmonton going to a Game 7 twice, actually. Vancouver once memorably on home ice with that 30-for-30 that we've been seeing the last couple of weeks about the riots. So
yeah, I didn't need to watch that. I knew guys covering it. I covered that too, but I didn't go back to Vancouver. That was crazy. They really had a chance there.
They really did. But it's a thing where, again, the last two Game 7s that we saw really in a lot of ways were stinkers, both in 2011 and 2019. So this one...
But not in 2004.
Not in 2004.
That was my second cup that I covered, and that was, yeah, Tampa and Calgary.
Yes.
And that could have gone either way.
It could have. And again, two very, very good teams in there. Calgary was a low seed, but...
Although 06, they went to 7 also.
Edmonton.
That's what you're saying.
Edmonton and Vancouver twice. You know,
right.
So it's one of those incredible, incredible things. And like you said, Calgary was the other team to get to a Game 7 in the time since. And this whole thing, I mean, I broke it down in last year's Pro Hockey Draftology, which, by the way, the new one up on the main page at FantasyDraftHelp.com, Pro Hockey Draftology 2024 for this year's draft. But I had a thing in there last year that if you added up not just Stanley Cups won, Sun Belt versus Canada, but if you added in conference championships and I think even conference final wins there, you know, it was something like 38-15 advantage Sun Belt, which is just really incredible. This is such a statistical anomaly, the likes of which I don't think will ever be properly explained by anybody. But the degree to which it has just been impossible for our frozen friends north of the border to be able to break through here when they had a number of teams good enough to do so. And game after game, time after time, even in situations like this one where Edmonton had all the momentum coming in, it still didn't matter.
Yeah, it's tough for them right now. There's no question about it. Also, people should listen to the SiriusXM NHL Network radio broadcast of the draft, if you have it, on 91. I'll be on the pregame and in the postgame for that draft, and I'm always on the draft floor and then eventually go in the back and start doing my other work. But, yeah, that's something where it's my 24th draft.
That is incredible. And let me ask you, since you're going to be there, like, the whole thing of, like, having it at the Sphere, what are you getting the sense is going to be incorporated as a part of this? Because anybody that hears that has very high expectations for the multimedia that's going to be involved in this thing. What are you hearing?
Well, it just so happens, Rick, that I got an email about that today.
Okay.
And I can tell your listeners just what's what.
Excellent.
I got to pull it up. Yep. So for this, as you know, and I do want to point this out, I did point it out about a week ago. Dana White shot his mouth off a year ago and said that the NHL doesn't know how to market. They're an old league. They don't know what the hell they're doing. And they obviously know enough to have the first, you know, big sport live event in that building before him. Mm-hmm. You know, that UFC that's going to run there is running after the NHL. How did that happen? Dana White. I must ask Dana White, who's the genius, how this possibly happened. But I wanted to point that out. Oh, actually, I had the wrong email, so we have to fill for another second.
All right.
But that's just something where it, you know, it does show that this is going to be something interesting. So the Sphere and the NHL have new details on custom content.
Okay.
So the Sphere Studios made some custom content that is going to give you real-time action taking place inside the venue on the LED exterior, separate from the original content the company creates for the Sphere experience.
Okay.
So they're going to have like two different kind of things going at once. They created multi-sensory live entertainment experiences exclusive for this. So again, yeah, this isn't bad marketing, Dana White. I mean, this is actually going to be pretty good. They're going to push the boundaries of technology, they say. And this is the first ever live broadcast event for a major sports league. So they want to really knock it out of the park, even though it's hockey, but, you know, you get
sure.
it.
Yeah.
And this is the first live television event from inside the Sphere. First time content on the interior display plane will be optimized for the fans and the viewing audience at home. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff here. So
first time
the events happening live inside the venue will be incorporated into the real-time content to be displayed on the Exosphere, which is, you know, the big snow globe on the outside.
Yep.
So, yeah, this has got great potential.
Well, that's one of those things where the external of it, I know, like, for Summer League, they like to turn it into a big basketball. And that's one of those things where I've seen videos of that. Like, there's going to be a big pile-up someday when somebody's driving their car, because it can look, I think, potentially like a big basketball, a giant basketball is rolling towards you. So that doesn't seem like the safest thing necessarily. I'm sure this stuff will be safer for people in traffic to look at, because I'm sure you can't miss it even when you're in traffic. So, we'll see what the broadcast looks like. I know you're going to have great coverage of it, and I'm sure going to have a great time being there at the Sphere in Las Vegas. Of course, your coverage in Pro Hockey Draftology 2024, as always, the backbone of the issue here, with your top player rating in there, your profiles that you have in there as well, and everything.
Nice.
And I dipped my toe in the water this year for the first time to try a mock draft. So being a brave man.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So, a little too brave for my own good, perhaps, but we shall see. But, that is out there for everybody to check out. Some early content for next year, some early predictions for next year, things to look forward to, free agency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So go check out.
Free agency, which is like the end of the week.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. You're giving a sense of, like, who's on the market, what's going to be, you know, things to be going after. So trying to stay time sensitive on all of these stories that are going to be happening here. So, there's never been a better time than right now to go check that out, download that. And, of course, there is never a better time and a better person, certainly, to break things down with after the Stanley Cup Finals than Russ Cohen, great FDH Lounge dignitary, Sportsology proprietor. So, Russ, thank you so much for your time, my friend. Have a great time in Vegas. You'll be killing it on the draft coverage this weekend.
Thanks, Red.
Appreciate it, Russ. Thank you so much, buddy. Thanks, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1734.